I've stressed or tried to, in the time we had available, the importance of a spiritual base. And it works like this. I've just been reminded that a lot of us have an awful lot of work to do, lots and lots of jobs, and we work off a very, very small spiritual base. And the result is that the thing has eventually got to topple down. You must try and get your base big enough to support the work you do. And that's so important. And that's why at camp I have a little saying to anybody at all, certainly to our staff. I'll say, "Hi, how are you? What verse was a blessing to your soul this morning?" "Oh," I said, "didn't you have a reading this morning?" "Well, that's not good enough. You have a reading before you come out." And we insist our staff have a morning quiet time. Meet God before you meet the world. And sometimes when I'm serving food, if I know the group, "Hi, how are you? What verse was it before you have my potatoes? Was a blessing to yours?" "Oh, Malcolm." And now the staff said, "I know, it's a psalm," and they've got it. But I do it for fun, but I'm serious deep down. Because you can work in a camp, and you can become a professional camp operator and be quite unspiritual. And I've been to lots of camps where that is the case. They're doing their job well, but there's no much spirituality there. It's not on a good, sound base. All right, we've said at the top here that no leader has the right to expect success unless he makes his task a priority. And your task has got to come first. You know, we often expect success and we haven't made our task the all-important thing. So you have to, when you're working at something, it's got to be meaningful. And so we've talked about Christ-likeness. And I said that, first of all, a leader needs to strive to be like Christ. And I've just suggested three things there. As the Father has sent me, and so he comes in the character of the Lord Jesus. In fact, you know, you hear about the commission of Matthew 28. It wasn't really a new commission. We just had the Lord's commission extended to us. As the Father sent me, so I send you, go into all the world. So he just renewed the commission to us. So in other words, in the same way in which the Lord Jesus came, we come with humility, thoughtfulness. And so that leads us to the next one. The Son of Man, this is the key verse to the Gospel of Mark, the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and give his life a ransom for many. Or the Son of Man came not to serve, not to be served, but to serve. Now this acetate is very important. And it isn't on your notes. But so many, many people think that leadership is getting things done through others. And most of the books you read, Leroy Imes and Ted M. Strong and all those guys, will say to you that leadership is getting a job done through others. That is not biblical leadership. Biblical leadership is this: meeting the needs of people as they work at accomplishing their jobs. Now, one of the reasons in some camps there's a tremendous turnover of staff is because the staff are totally unfulfilled. You must make sure that your staff have got a job satisfaction. If not, eventually they will die out. This is the thought here, you see, in this one. Now, this is the cooperation style. I'll meet your need. That's real leadership. If you become a member of our team, you'll be able to fulfill your need as you work at fulfilling ours. The usual method of leadership is, you've got to meet my need. And that's a tragedy, that one. That becomes a little diatrophe sitting on the pile of a lot of people pushing buttons. Go here, come here, do this, do that. And eventually people just say, "Bust you, Fred. I have got a personality and a character of my own. I have got goals of my own. I've got a life of my own. And I am totally unfulfilled here." Or look at this chart. You see, the team's goal may be there in the middle, but the people sort of give up because they've got personal skills that are not being used. Frustrated. There's a lack of accomplishment. I don't feel I'm doing anything in this job. I've known people quite competent
and they've left the campsite. So why ever did you leave? Well, I just wasn't accomplishing anything. You know, they just wouldn't let me do anything there. I just got fed up. I wasn't allowed to make any decisions. Just remember staff meeting. Will you just put a ring around that so don't forget that, Keller? Not good staff meeting. All right, but a lack of accomplishment. Unable to serve one's interest in the group. Your own personal goals are not being met. You want to reach certain goals, and they're not being met there. There's a team conflict as well, conflicting with others, or your conflict outside as well as inside, and then various priorities you may have. And so these people are drawn two ways. There's the team's goal or the camp's goal, because we're all a team, but then there's these other things pulling them out, a lack of accomplishment, not using their personal skills, and so on and so forth. And these begin to drag at these people. And so that brings us then to this one. The team member. They need to be able to use their own personal skills and creativity. Now that brings us to this staff meeting you're hanging on to. A staff meeting at camp in regard to leadership is tremendously important, and ours is absolutely important. From 9 o'clock in the morning till 10:30 at night. We work a 7-day week, which is unbiblical. You have 2 days off, that's a month is your time off. Single men, and all men rather, must be up and dressed and showered by 7:30. The wife is their problem. Single women must be up and dressed and showered by 7:30. Showered. Got to have a shower. It's a law. And clean your teeth. And that's every day. But Monday, as long as you're up and dressed and showered by 9 o'clock in my study, you can lie in until then. That's so you have your lie-in morning. But the value of our staff meeting is that the youngest staff member or the newest staff member, they've been there now a month and they've got the feel of things. And they'll say, you know, I was wondering the other day, why don't we? For instance, when we serve up, we never serve out of a saucepan. We would never serve out of a saucepan. Obviously, it's bad and it's for the Lord. It's not good enough. And so we have stainless steel bowls and we put all our food in stainless steel bowls. So put in mashed potato. You mash your mashed potato up and you put your seasoning in your mashed potato, which is very, very nice. You might have cheese potato or whatever, and it's all lovely. You put it in the bowl and then we scallop it with a little scallop, and then get a cloth and you wipe around the bowl so there's no marks on the bowl. It's put there, okay. Now, the jolly thing rattles when you're trying to get it out and put it on the plate. It's a nuisance, and we've been, for 16 years I've been at this camp, wondering how to fix it. We put rubber little squabs under it. You know, they don't look very good. The little rubber, dishcloth things. You know, we cut them and wet them and put them on. But, they don't look that good. Junior member said, why don't we buy some rubber mats? That's pretty basic. Do you know, I've been there for 16 years and never thought about buying rubber mats. You know, I'm thick. All right, I'm thick. I admit that. So we bought the rubber mats. Now, the point is that I'm making is not trying to tell you I'm thick. You've arrived there. But I'm trying to tell you that this kid got an idea. Why don't we use rubber mats? He just said, you know, those bowls are easy. Why don't we get rubber mats? And he went to, we have a place called Para Rubber. And he got these little rubber mats. They're about that big. And they're brown and they're very nice. And they go under our bowl. And it just is the last thing. And nothing rattles, nothing spins, and everything's just firm. And they're far better than these grotty-looking cloths. And they're just so good. Now the point is, every time we put those mats out, it's his idea. And you're just building him up a little bit. You've got to let everybody on the staff feel they contribute. You can't have the big cheese sitting on the top making all the decisions. You must allow your staff to feel part of your leadership. Remember, the key to leadership is to surround yourself with people better than you are. And so our staff meeting, you're not allowed to have a baby on the staff meeting. You're not allowed to have, you know, go to the doctor, go to the dentist. Nobody does anything. You must be at the staff meeting. Kids come and they play in a little room outside that's arranged for them, play with toys, and we leave the door so we can see them. But all the staff are there. But the reason for the staff meeting is not just so that we go through the day. We have a devotion. We do all that sort of stuff. We all pray together. I meant to bring our staff minutes today, and I forgot. My wife sent them to me, and I meant to bring them. And our staff minutes are printed by the time we all leave. We all go and have morning tea together. And then as people leave, they virtually get the minutes. But the point is trying to give people a sense of belonging. That's what this is about. Their creativity to assist in the team's efforts. That was their idea. And there are lots of things that we do at our camp that are really the ideas of everybody else. I get all the credit for it. They said, Malcolm, you've done a wonderful job at Toad Springs. No, I haven't. I get the credit and I feel better about it. Totus Springs is what it is because of the genius of everybody else. I just walk around and look intelligent. And that's all. And everybody makes their own contribution. The need to be accepted by the other team members. A sense of acceptability. Some people may be overweight. Some people may have other difficulties. They're not very fit. They can't do this. And they've been shunned a little bit, maybe at a church. But they're accepted for what they are, and they've got a value. Now, the only thing that I insist that everybody dresses, we had a guy, and he'd been in trouble with the police, and we took him on. He was a Christian. And he dressed horribly, and I will not allow anybody. We don't allow jandals in our kitchen, obviously, because it's just sloppy. And so you must wear shoes and socks, and ladies wear a sort of a sandal thing. I don't know what they wear. They get around it, but they'll wear jandals. But this guy came in with grotty shirts and a few stains on it. And so, rather than embarrass him, he hadn't got any money, I went to town and bought him two shirts and gave them to him. And I said, look, lad, you know, we want you to be part of the team. Just wear these when you're in the kitchen serving. Apart from that, I don't care what you wear around the grounds when you're working and digging poles and posts and so on. But when you're in the kitchen, just make sure you've had a bit of a clean up, put a shirt on. I wanted him to belong. I didn't want to feel an oddball. And people must feel I am part of that team and my opinions listened to. Back to your staff meeting. You know, what do you think about that? What do you think about that? What's your thought? Oh, no, yeah, well, come on, you've got an idea. Do you know that guy listens to what I say? But I've been to some staff meetings where the guy does all the talking. And he just bulldozes over everybody with his ideas. And so the camp revolves around him. He's what's known as this. Oh, it's about time he may have thought himself and he does that.
That's not
a new black, to be quite honest. Beware of this person. The strong, natural, he usually ends up as his own biggest, worst enemy. He lives by the seat of his pants, he never plans, and because he's got great charisma and a tremendous leader, he's terrific. You remove him and the whole thing collapses. And he usually becomes unlivable with. It's his word or nobody's, and that person is really a very weak kind of person. So watch it. And your staff meeting gets away from all those sort of problems. All right, the need for my personal goals to be compatible with the team's. So just going round, I'm thinking of Touchspring. Now, we have problems at Touchspring. Don't get the idea that we're perfect. That'd be stupid. We have little hiccups and problems and difficulties and disagreements. Of course we do. But we have a man who is a brilliant builder, our camp manager. And every year I try to make sure that he has a building project. Now, you can't always have a building project at his camp. And so I make sure that I let him off, say, for maybe 3 weeks or a month or 2 months. Last year he went down to Queenstown to their camp and completely rearranged the whole camp for them. It was getting quite tatty. And I was preaching down there at Eastern, so it was a bit of a mess. And said, look, you folk, what are you doing about this? So, oh, nothing. Where to start? We have people come out, they do a bit of painting, and they're more trouble than they're worth. Our guy will come down if you like. You fly him down, he'll be down here and he'll work out a work schedule for you. And he did. He went to Resene Paint, I think, and he got 50% off wholesale prices for the paint, the whole thing. He got a work schedule, what they needed, when they needed, and what to do it, and then a rearrangement of some of the buildings. He's going down there later this year to help them with their new building project. He'll be down there for possibly a month. We'll do without him. But he's getting job satisfaction. You see, if this guy here's a song leader, I'll try and make sure whenever I can he leads the singing in the groups. This person's a pianist, that person's an artist. This person's met on gardening, our farm manager, she loves gardening. I would never dream of, I love gardening too, and so occasionally I get out there, but I would never dream of touching the other that centre. Joe, now what do you think about this? And we work together, the gardens are hers, and I make sure that when people say to me, Malcolm, your gardens look beautiful, I know. Joe, could you come over here a minute? These folk are just saying about the gardens, will you say that again? Oh, Malcolm, don't be silly, you know. I said, come on. But she walks away thinking that somebody noticed. It's important to notice. You notice when someone looks tired. You notice when someone looks angry. You notice when a lady's just had her hair done. Ooh, ooh. You know. You notice when they happen. I've gone to a lot of our staff and said, excuse me, but your hair is a little bit grotty. It's lank and it's dead and it's not shining and that's not good enough. And I say, I'd like you to be a bit tidier. You can do that if you've earned the right to do it. But if you haven't earned the right, you get your face slapped. All right? So but they've got to feel part of it. So that's that one there. And the last one is the need to be allowed to represent others, not on the team. In other words, to be a voice often. You know, what you want to do at your camp is this, and they want to be able to feel they can make that kind of contribution. So that brings us back to Christ-likeness. We're there not to bully, but to be a servant. And the Lord Jesus washed the disciples' feet. We're just going to go through these very, very quickly, if you don't mind. We now come to discipline, and we've said there, an undisciplined person is a liability, and I said the disciplined Mr. Average will probably accomplish more in the end than an undisciplined Mr. Brilliant. There are some guys, and they are brilliant, but you can never depend on them. They're not there, they forgot, or next week, and I didn't have time, and I meant to get around to it, and they're terribly difficult to live with. But there's a guy, and he slogs away, and he disciplines his life, and when the dust settles at the end, that guy, he may have run like the tortoise, but you'd be amazed what he did. Now, Mr. Brilliant's always getting the pats on the back, because he's smart, he's got a tremendous sense of humour, everybody's always around him laughing. But you have to be what? When the dust settles, what did that guy do today? What did he really accomplish? I didn't see him talking to anybody, I didn't see him with his arm around anybody, you know, metaphorically. I didn't see him washing the benches down. I didn't see him picking things up. You know, I always end up at the end there with my pocket full of lolly papers at a camp. You know, you see papers, you pick up. I saw a peg, then I pick it up. See something on the ground, you pick it up. I was in Matamero, that's our town where we live with my daughter the other day, and I saw some papers. She said, "Oh, Dad, you know, don't pick it up." You know, and I just pick it up from the rubbish tin. It's just a thing you do when you're a youth worker. You're picking up somebody else's rubbish. You just do it automatically. But I've never seen him do that, you see. Now, he may be a lot of noise. And certainly, when you put him up there in front of 200 people, leave the singing, he is fantastic. But is he worth it just for that? Because he creates an awful lot of problems otherwise. Now, a disciplined genius is brilliant. But an undisciplined genius is a liability, and often a problem, and difficult. So be careful of that one. It's a real challenge. I've talked about bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now, talking quickly about these other things that we've got here. The things in regard to your personal discipline. What do you think about? I often say to folk, and you know, that what do you think about when you go to bed at night? That's where a lot of people get immoral thoughts. I have a rule for young people, young men particularly, I don't know much about young girls, when you wake up, get up. Don't lie in bed with immoral thoughts, you'll find yourself getting involved in all sorts of immoral fantasies. When you wake up, get up. And that's a rule that I just have to get for single men. Don't lie there. Don't lie there fantasizing. If you've got a problem, get out of bed. What do you do with your mind? Do you ever let your mind wander and you imagine that you have an imaginary conversation with somebody you don't like, and they're 100 miles away and you thought this, and he would have said this, and I would have said that, and you get yourself in a bad mood? Mind anyone that does it? Is it dumb? You know, you're just assassinating yourself. I mean, the person miles away, they didn't even know you exist at the moment. Your mind, control it. Where's your mindset? Your reading time. Expand your mind. You know, even the Reader's Digest. Everybody jokes about the Reader's Digest, but read it more than the fun is. You know, that I always read, you know, the fun is first, and then the real life dramas next. And then the book section next, and then whatever is interesting. And we had a marvelous article there the other day on a lady has a washing machine that always loses one of the socks. And my wife always loses one of my socks. Oh, darling, where's the other one? You know, there's an article about that. You're not the only woman in the world. But you get lots of good little things out of the, but it expands your mind. There are lots of good magazines that you can get. I mean, obviously your New Zealand Church Journal is a must for everybody. You know? I'm so serious. Ours is called The Treasury. What's yours called? Pardon? What is it? Outreach. That's your, that's the assembly one, is it? New South Wales. Well, you should get it and read it. So you're part of it. You know what's going on. Ours has some good articles, but ours has a missionary emphasis. Well, you know where all the missionary movements are. If you're going to pray intelligent, you need that. So read that. Have some little book that you're reading through. I normally read a little book at night. I'm going through a similar book by Vance Havner at the moment. Or I read a chapter a night before I go to bed. Now, you think, well, you should read the Bible. If I read the Bible, I start studying and wondering what that meant. I get up and pull a book down and find out what that meant. So I read a little book, and I have a little pen with me, little colouring and things. It's a good idea, then I just underline it and go to bed. But you can use your mind, but your mind can just turn off. I carry these around with me. You know those little stick-on pads? Always got one of those in my pocket, you know? And you're waiting for somebody to come, and you have a bright idea. You just scribble it down. And, you know, and the ideas we get through the day are good. Hang on to them. You see things that want doing around your campsite. I always carry these little pads. You know, that fence post has got to be straightened up. That gate wants realigning, or those deer want drenching, and I just put it down there. Because when you get back to your office, now, what were those three things? So use your mind. Make sure that your mind is in control. The use of your time, we waste time, we've talked about that. Recreation, make sure you have a recreation, but make sure your recreation doesn't become a master, like your hobby mustn't become a master. Money, use it wisely. I'd love to talk about these and spend time, but we're going to get beaten if I do. But the way you use your money isn't yours to do as you like with. It isn't that I've given my tithe, I can spend the rest. Money in your pocket is no proof that you can spend it on what you like. Because you can afford it, it doesn't mean say it's God's will. Did you need that other pair of shoes? Did you need that coat? I like to dress tidily. But I look at some people's wardrobes and goodness, and where's Jesus and Lord? Can't be! With all that. Very sad. Be wise with the way you use your money. Never waste it. Why do you think they picked up the 12 baskets that remained up, that fed the Jesus wasn't having a clean up Israel campaign. I mean, if you can feed 5,000, only number the men, because we're the only ones worth numbering, and there would have been women there as well, because they're always interested in noticing what's going on, I'm running dangerous, and little kids there. There might have been 15,000 people he fed out of 5 loaves and 2 fishes. If you can feed 15,000 people out of 5 loaves and 2 fishes, you don't need to carry up the baskets that remain. Why did he pick them up? He picked them up because they were going to use them. Just because you're richly blessed doesn't mean to say you can waste it. And I've seen camps that have had some legacy has been left them of some thousand, and they've just blown it, wasted it, stupid, bought little bikes and pool tables, and they just wasted it, squandered it. And then they're looking for money and wonder why. You've got some money in your pocket, you think twice before you spend it. It's God's. Use it wisely for God. You waste it, the Lord will deal with you. Behavior, public, your example before others. So we'll move down that one there. Alright. Under the public one, you've got the follower's commitment to the Lord. What I mean by that is simply this. You're in charge of a camp, say, or you're in charge of a rally, or anything that you're a leader of. You're the leader. What authority have you got to make people do as you tell them? What authority have you got to tell them off? You see, this person here is always late for study circles in our camp. Always late. Good leader, comes tearing in, hair flying, books, drops them. Terrific leader, always late. And I want to tell her off. Now what right, I don't pay her a wage, she's given up her holiday to be here. In fact, she's going to go home exhausted. She loves the Lord so much, she's given up a holiday to be with us. It's the only annual holiday she gets. She's given up a holiday, she's with us. She's giving the best she's got, but she's always late. Now what right have I got to tell her off? All these two jerks here, you see, they nicked out, their cabin was asleep. And when the cabin was asleep, they sneaked out, they got in the kitchen, had a feed, and they went for a swim in the pool. And they were still swimming there 11 o'clock at night. Now they worked very hard, they were up at 6 o'clock in the morning. They gave it their very best. Their cabin was asleep. They sneaked out, went for a swim. Now I'm going to do those guys. What right have I got to do them? That's the last time you do it. Don't do it. Will you please be honest? What right have I got? What is the basis of my discipline over Christians who don't get a wage? The only basis you've got is their commitment. And I say, look, fellas, I'm awfully feel lousy about this. You went through like that, didn't you? Yeah. Well, you know you're not allowed, don't you? You didn't. Oh, you should have done. You should have read the rules. Well, you're not. And I'm awfully sorry. You can't do it again, fellas. Now, if they're committed to the Lord Jesus and He's Lord, they'll take that and say, sorry, no, you know, yeah, we understand. If they say, well, you can stuff your camp, I don't want them back anyway. I don't want people I've got to chase around and beg them to do things. I don't want them. There are people who can't stand the ground I walk on, the people who will never come to Total Sprints. There was a girl, she was doing a text, you know, one of those little texts and on a piece of card, and she didn't line it, she ran off at the end. You know, the words went up bigger than the bottom it, and she went off at the end with little tiny letters because she couldn't fit all in. And I said, I'm sorry, darling, but that's just not good enough. You have to do it again. Do you mind, love? I hate saying it. Oh, I can't do any better than that. And I said, yes, you can, love. You could have underlined it with a rule. If you put your lines out first, just mark them down and underline it, and follow your lines, you'll find it's super. Well, there's not a rule around. An angel zapped down and dropped a yardstick just there. There was one just there. And I said, here you are, do you use this? And she got it and smashed it on the leg and threw it down and stormed off. Do it yourself. Buster. Camp, when you're running a camp, is not the place to help somebody with their lordship. We've got all these little kids we're trying to win for the Lord. These teams trying to win for the Lord. You haven't got time to fluff around with uncommitted leaders. So anyway, she can't apologize. She didn't mean it. And about 3 or 4 months later, somebody met her in the town and said, by the way, you come back to Turtle Springs? I wouldn't go near that Malcolm Barrow for all the money in the world. Well, he wouldn't want you near him either. And so if you set a standard that is people's loyalty to Christ, you don't get deadheads. But if you're weak and undisciplined yourself, you've got a whole lot of deadheads and they're a nuisance. You're not only putting the kids to bed, you're putting the leaders to bed. And you're begging, would you mind doing this? You haven't got time. So the only basis of discipline you've got is the depth of their commitment. And if their commitment's very shallow, then your discipline is pretty, pretty weak. So surround yourself with committed people. Rather have 10 committed people than 100 uncommitted Christians. They're a problem. And so discipline is tremendously important. I've said here, discipline, confusion is the hearse that carries all our dreams to the grave. And so many people have fantastic ideas, but through lack of discipline, they botch it. I've also talked about this very quickly. Which would you say was the, you'd put those first in order, the important thing, the urgent thing, the unpleasant thing, or the pleasant? Which would you do first? Any ideas? You could say that.
Yes.
Well, a lot of people do, and that's the weakness. It depends what the urgent thing is, of course. If it's take the next breath, do it. But one of the problems is that the urgent thing is not very important. It's there and it's in front of you, and so you do it because it's right in front of you and appears to be urgent, but there's a terribly important thing to do. Now, I've got to wash the dishes. That's urgent. The important thing is I've got to prepare a message. Now, can't do both. The important thing has got to come first. Lots of us live on the urgent things, and we just do the things that are urgent. And we never get round to the important things. I've seen guys, and I said, you're preaching on Sunday. Our staff, our students that are preaching, we've got 4 of them, and they have to give me their sermons outline on Monday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they come to me, Thursday night, it gets timed up. And I say, hey, fella, you haven't been in yet, and it's Wednesday, come on. Malcolm, I haven't had time. Uh-huh. You've been doing the urgent things, buddy boy, but you haven't been doing the important things. Now, you've got to sort yourself out. Because a lot of urgent things, they seem urgent, but they're not important. They're just little things. So just give them 5 minutes, just give them 2 minutes. The other mistake we make is we do all the pleasant things, the things we like doing. They're nice. I like doing that. I like watering the garden. I like mowing the lawns. I like doing this. But it's not your job. Don't do it. And so my rule is I usually do the important things first and the unpleasant things, or I have to toss up between those two. So if you wake up in the morning and you've got something miserable to do, an unpleasant thing, to write a letter to a leader or write a letter to a mother the mother rang and she was very, very angry about the state her child got home and that all the clothes are wet in the case and the child hadn't even opened the packet of toothpaste. You see, you obviously had a dumb leader. But you got the crack and you have got to go and visit her or write to her and apologise. You put it off because it's unpleasant. You know, how are you going to do it? So you put it off, right? And then the next day there's another unpleasant thing you put off. Now, you're worrying about it all the time. Uh-huh. Now, you've got 2 things you're worrying about. You're burning nervous energy. And the next day, there's another thing and another thing. At the end of the week, you've got a mountain of unpleasant things. And you don't know how you're going to face it. And so what do? You just let it go. You pretend it isn't there. Then you get criticized for not facing up your responsibilities. But you wake up in the morning and you deal with your unpleasant things. You write that letter. First thing you do. It's important. And it's unpleasant, do it. So you take your pen out, and you write to that lady. And you write the letter, and you put it in an envelope, and you post it off. You're not worrying about it anymore. It's downhill the rest of the day. But see, if you put your unpleasant things off, you're burning nerves in you, because they're always there. They niggle away at you. They rob you of your joy. You know you've got to face them one day. And that's why a lot of people have nervous breakdowns. They keep putting off these things, and putting them off, and putting them off, and putting them off, and putting them off, until there's a mountain in front of them they don't know what to do, so they nibble away at the pleasant things. Eventually they get fired or they get sacked, and it's very sad. Commitment, application, concentration on what you're doing. Quality that you need to have. I can't spend a lot of time there, but it's certainly important. The quality, a love for the Lord Jesus, obvious, and a love for people. If you can't love people, pray for them. I have a problem in our camps with intellectually handicapped children. I know I shouldn't, and I know it's bad, but I do. They're incontinent. They're smelly. they don't blow their noses, and they're a real problem. And I have a real difficulty with them. I'm winning now over the years, but I've had real problems. I can handle handicapped children, physically handicapped, but mentally handicapped, I've had a real problem with. I remember when I learnt the lesson. Animals are fabulous with those sort of children. We've got some nice horses, and they're good, and we only get quiet animals. Everything's pretty tame around our place, even the ferrets. I was playing with one the other day, chopped my finger off, you know, grew again. But when you put somebody on a horse, now if we put you on a horse, and the horse could get you off because you'd be an idiot, didn't know where the brakes were, it would do so. But a handicapped kid, it's amazing, they seem to know, and as soon as the kid begins to sit, the horse stops. They seem to have that, it's most interesting. Well, I got this boy, he was about 13, and he was all, you know, and everywhere, and he was all running nose, and I got my handkerchief and blew his nose, and he wanted his bag changing, and he hadn't been done, and I got to lift him up onto this horse, and we have one person leads the horse, then two of us on either side. And so we got him up on the horse, a lot of effort, and he was sitting there very, very happy, and we just took him around, and I was holding on to him, and every time he'd sit, the horse stopped, but I just held him. And I didn't like doing that job. And as I went around, I said, Lord, I really want to love this kid. You can't serve the Lord if you don't love people. People know if you care. No preacher will ever communicate to his audience if he doesn't have a care for them. He's just going to browbeat them with verses. You might give them a guilty conscience, but you'll never help them because they know they're not loved. If you don't love your audience, stay away. I mean, I'm not being silly and sentimental. I care. You care to come. And I want to care for this kid. But I knew that if I put my arm around him at the end or, you know, what I was doing was I was being a hypocrite. I didn't like this kid. I didn't love him. I didn't want it. So I said, Lord, help me to love this kid. And when we got around, we got back, I helped him off. And I still said, Lord, I want to love this kid. Nose was ringing. And he tried to thank me. And he said, huh. And he couldn't. And he rushed forward and put his arms around and gave me a great big hug. And I won. And I hugged him back. And that was a breakthrough. That's happened many times. People you don't like, even in your church, staff you have a problem with, they're the people you pray for the most. A tolerance. Be tolerant. Don't be dogmatic and always got to have your own way, and bulldogmatic is ridiculous. A reasonability. Some sort of imagination. Now, if you haven't got much imagination, and I suffer from a lack of imagination, work with blank sheets of paper. Try to come up with ideas. What could I do? Read, talk, discuss it, brainstorm. Resilience, so that you don't get thrown off beam just because people don't agree with you. Like to talk a lot about that, can't. A reliability. Don't be late. Got it? Be relied upon. If so-and-so's on that abseiling tower, you don't have to worry. But if so-and-so's on that abseiling tower, I'm not happy about them being up there. They'll be clowning around and being smart, being an idiot, and I'm nervous. You need people that are reliable, dependable. People are taking the canoes. You've got canoes at Tukli. You wouldn't dare put some idiot there that lets them go out in their life jackets. Fools around, lets them crash. Doesn't teach them how to get out, you know, fall out of a canoe and all that sort of stuff. Somebody down there using the opportunity to boost to themselves and to look after the kids. You're a nervous wreck. You know, one day if you carry on, you're going to have a problem. Better to hurt the person and look up. I'm awfully sorry. Just don't trust you. Sorry. Rather than lose a life. Lose a life in your camp. It's a thing I dread when anything else. You know, I was with a group once. I was the speaker at their group, thank goodness. And we were looking over a waterfall. It was very, very, very long way down. And so we could all go to the edge and look over. They put a rope around us, you see, so that we were safe. And they had the rope belayed around a tree. And nobody needed it. We all just put the rope around and had a look over and came back. As we were going back up the stream, there was a log going down. And the guy got the rope. He had a loop in it. And he threw it over a branch that was sticking up. And eventually he lassoed it. Gave it a jerk and the rope broke. It was rotten. You know, our hearts just went, boom. We'd all been trusting that, right? That leader was an idiot. He never tested his rope. Just an idiot. Could have lost a life. It takes a camp a long time to get over losing a life. There have been camps that have lost lives, and oh dear, oh dear. Stability, and all those things you can see there, tremendously important. Enthusiasm. Look, enthusiasm in your camp work is half the battle. Somebody said it couldn't be done, but he with a chuckle replied that maybe it couldn't. But he'd be the one that wouldn't say no till he'd tried. And there's nothing like having an enthusiastic person. Be enthusiastic yourself. It's amazing what you do. What do you think of this? You can do anything if you have enthusiasm. It's in your notes. Enthusiasm is the yeast that makes your hopes rise to the stars. Enthusiasm is the sparkle in your eyes. Enthusiasm is the swing in your gait, the grip of your hand. Enthusiasm is the irresistible surge of your will and your energy to execute your ideas. Enthusiasts are fighters. They have fortitude. They have staying qualities. Enthusiasm is at the bottom of all progress. Notice these last two lines. With it, there is accomplishment. Without it, there are only alibis. You can change a whole thing with being enthusiastic. Remember a while ago, a girl came and said, "Oh, Malcolm, you've given me a miserable team and they're stupid kids and I can't get them to do anything. And, oh, I've got this game to play." And she was, moan, she was an idiot. And I said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, we're playing volleyball." "Righto, let's go." So off we went. There were the kids all being idiots, taking after their leader. Doesn't take anything. You stand there, "Righto, kids, let's go. You're over there. Let's get the ball over. That's tremendous. Oh, you missed it. Okay, let's do it again. Come on there. That's tremendous. Oh, you just missed it." You just stand there and you're enthusiastic. And the team, the game was different. She said, "Well, I wouldn't have believed it." "Of course you wouldn't, dear. I mean, I didn't tell her that. You're just like a blob. Just standing there." And it's amazing. You can be enthusiastic. You can, when you meet people, let your eyes say things. I've got glasses. Let your eyes say, "Hi, good to see you." Let them feel in your grip in your hand and the smile in your face. The warmth. Be enthusiastic. You can change a whole atmosphere by just being enthusiastic. Or you can just be, "Well, I guess we've got another lecture here today and, oh, we've got another 250 blooming kids coming in again for another camp. And, oh, I sometimes wonder if it's worth it." In a camp, I don't know how yours run, but we have activities. We have 250 a time, and that's a lot of kids, and we have structured activities. It's fairly tight. And there are some activities they like, some they don't. The most like horses, particularly girls. They like go-kart, they like BMX bikes, they like archery, they like shooting. The slave train, that's one of my creations. They like that most of the time. Depends who's on it. And various things they like, but they don't like softball. That's not a best one. They sometimes don't like outdoor hockey. They've never played before. That's not a best one. There are some they don't like. And so you see, there's the leader, and you say, "Well, our team, four girls and five girls, you're on outdoor hockey." And the leader goes, "Oh, have we got to do it, Malcolm?" "Yes, lady, you've got to do it, and you have just made for yourself 45 minutes of misery, because you've just sold it to your kids." Now, I tell leaders this. Now, she doesn't want to go out and play hockey. It's just been raining and the ground's wet. She's got to go and change, poor soul. Going to get her fingernail dirty. But she says, "Terrific! Okay, kids, let's get changed. We're going to get out there and we're going to win." Didn't cost her anything. Change the whole atmosphere. And those kids dash around and they get it in. They go out there and they have a marvellous time. They come back covered in mud and blood. And they've had a fabulous time. And all she did was just be enthusiastic. And you know, the person, someone said that one of the greatest instruments the devil uses is a yawn. Oh. No idea what it does to a creature. Or does to a group. What? Sorry?
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you yawn. You're doing your best and somebody... You see? But when they're enthusiastic... You know, there's a guy last night, I was preaching in Oakley, and there are one or two people there that are not as enthusiastic as one might be. And on the first night, there was a gentleman. He's a lovely guy, and he was a bit suspicious of this Kiwi, you see, and he sat there... He weighed everyone. I said, even little funny things I said, I made sure that the theology was correct. Nothing careless, you know. And I crossed every T and dotted every I with great care. But I, with me after a while, we had a little bit of fun and I saw him smile a bit. Well, last night, you know, he's in the middle there. And he was a real help. You see, the congregation is 50% responsible for what they get from the preacher. Believe that. This guy gave me 100%. You know. He was smiling and, amen, and he'd get it. You know, go like that. You've got something, you think. We're doing Hebrews, you can't miss, you know. And I went to him after, I said, "Look, sir, I don't know who you are, but thank you for tonight." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Look, you were such an enthusiast. You know, every time I looked at you, you were smiling, you were happy, you know, and we talked together. So he gave me so much last night, just by sitting in the pew." And I preach a lot of audiences. and we're preaching the gospel, and there's three people unsaved, and the bloomin' Christians are idiots. They're not even on your side. They're not even going the same way. Two over there are talking, a couple over there are fidgeting around, somebody over there is drawing something, some clot over here is half asleep, and the other one is yawning. And you're doing the best you can! And you're making a fizz of it, and you know the Christians. They're the ones that know you're having a trouble. They're sensitive, and they know it's a problem, and they bow their head for you. Because they're with you in your message, and they're praying for those people. But a lot of people just go to church for performance, and that's all they come away with. Their life is never different. So, cooperation is tremendously important. We need to learn to cooperate. Communication, let people know. When God wanted to botch the work of the Tower of Babel, what did he do? He just wrecked the communication. That's all. Simple. He didn't knock anything down, he just wrecked the communication. Once they couldn't communicate, end of the Tower of Babel. And when you look at your enterprise, your camp, or whatever you're involved in, when you have problems, usually you can trace it back to a breakdown in communication. Somebody didn't tell them. Or I didn't know that was your idea. It's not good enough to say, look, I think we should do this. You need to communicate your idea. Sell the idea so they're with you. Cooperation. Communication, sorry, consideration for the total goal. And then compassion for people as you cooperate with them. They need to understand. And I said at the bottom, people are more important than your projects. Don't let your project destroy people. We're now talking about goals. And in your leadership, it's important to have some goals. He who aims at nothing is sure to hit it. We're on the last lecture and we're just going to go a few minutes over time a little bit. Goal setting. And I want one or two things to say about goal setting, but the first thing is, at the top of your notes there, goal setting must be realistic. Have a goal that is within the capabilities of God's work in your life. Don't be silly. So make sure that your goal is realistic, that you review your goal from time to time. We'll spend a bit more on that in a moment. That your goal is communicated to the whole staff or whoever's with you, know exactly what your aims are. So you've got to share, communicate your goal so they all support you in it. Now, I believe that the Church of God is unstoppable. If we want to do something, all hell can't stop us. That's what Jesus said, the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. And we'll knock the gates down wherever we find them. If we want to, if we're united. But if we're not united, and the goal or our aims are not communicated to the crowd, so they're not with us, then it's all fragmented. And time again, that's where it is. You know, the Louis Palau mission that started in Fiji today and it's just about to start in New Zealand. It's very sad because there are a number of churches refuse to be involved. And evangelical churches. And I'm sorry for them, but I feel that we didn't communicate. They didn't feel wanted enough. And sometimes you take a lot of work to communicate. And then re-evaluate what you've done. Ask yourself the question, where will this goal fit into the overall task? If we do this, where does it lead to? This one's important also. How are we going to maintain it? Let's start night classes at Emmaus. Brilliant idea, maybe. How are we going to maintain it? And who's going to come? Let's have a camp for senior citizens. Let's have a camp for crippled children. Terrific! Who are the leaders going to be? How will we maintain it? Where will we get the money from? Anybody can come up with bright ideas. You know, cheese and biscuits before you go to bed at night. I have lots of bright ideas. But you've got to make sure your bright ideas are God's. Now, talking about goals, I've given the other side of goals. It's in your notes right in front of you. And this is Richard Halvorson said this. The trouble with goals, they so easily, so imperceptibly, so subtly, so irresistibly become God's. They become possessive, demanding, dictatorial. Instead of motivating, they compel. They require loyalty and then final allegiance. They brook no interference. Deprioritize all other interests and values. When the goal becomes a god, the process by which it is achieved becomes less and less important. Any means is justified in pursuit of the end. The goal is achieved at too great a price. Often loved ones are sacrificed, whole families, wives and children virtually abandoned, principles and morals forsaken, even God rejected. The only safe goal is the glory of God, in which case means are as important as ends. So that's the other side of goals. I'm all for goals. I have my own personal goals. I expect our staff to have their goals. But make sure your goal does not become your God. And so you hold your goals lightly, you review them. So that leads us to this. Now, some people don't agree with planning, and I'm not going to spend time on that. You've got it in your notes. But the Apostle Paul planned to do things. All right. Then, this is the idea. You have a purpose. There's your purpose. There. That's what you want to do. That's the overall thing you want to do. Reach children for Christ. All right? And we need some goals to accomplish our main purpose. Next week we're talking about the philosophy of camps and how often we need to review our purpose or our philosophy. What was good enough 5 years ago may need reviewing now. Maybe there's a different lot of people out there we've got to reach. Don't hang on to a philosophy, it becomes a tradition. Alright, that's tragedy. So you've got your purpose, then you've got your goals, then you set your plans. How are we going to do this? And you work out your plans so you can accomplish your goals, so that you can act. And everybody can act. We know what we're doing. The Sahara Desert. Okay, hang on to that. But then you need to be ready to change. Plans will probably change. So we'll have to act again, reevaluate our goal. Alright, to eventually reach our goal, we need to reevaluate. How did we get on? Are we reaching our purpose? See, what happens is that's the purpose. But we stay on the goal, and the goal becomes the God, and we lose sight of the overall purpose. See, our purpose at Total Springs is to reach people for Christ and to bring other people closer to Christ, discipleship. We can spend more time on the grounds than on preparing our ministry. We can spend more time grooming horses than we do on our ministry. We can spend more time patching up canoes than we do on our ministry. We can be more fussy about serving food than loving people. So that the secondary issue, the goal, the little goal that we had to reach, that we want nice food, we want our boats good, we want our horses good. But all that's just to get people saved. It's dumb if the little goals take the place of the purpose. You lose sight of the purpose. You're so busy doing all these little things, you never get around to people. And I've sometimes said to staff members, hey, you know, we're flat out here. Have you witnessed to any of these school teachers today? I mean, they've been here all day. If you're in secular work, you'd be thinking, must witness now on the bus, got a witness. On the train, got a witness. You know, walking out, got a witness. Over the work, got a witness. Got a witness. But when we run a camp, we're so busy being Christians, we forget a witness. And a whole bunch of unsaved kids, we do our devotional talk with them, we preach at them, but no witness. And we miss the bus. So don't let your goal become your God. That's what I mean with that cycle. That's your purpose. Get your goals organized so you can get your purpose done. Set your plans carefully so that you can reach your goal. Then you can act because you've got specific plans. That's how we're going to do it. But often plans have to change. Things happen. The weather goes wrong. Your staff aren't as many as they thought. You've got more staff. All sorts of things happen. So be malleable. Be prepared to change. Don't be cast iron and dictatorial and big and bossy. God knows better. And then you can act again. Eventually reach your goals. These. Reevaluate. Are we reaching our original purpose? I submit a camp report to our trust board regularly. And often I restate on the report that I give. I always type my report. And by the way, if you're in a meeting and you're not the chairman and the boss, and I'm not with my trust board, I'm just the director, don't just type out one, your report. So that's your report. Don't just type out two. That's for the chairman and that's for the secretary. Never do that. Type out one for everybody. Always type out enough for everybody. It only maybe cost you 10 cents a copy. And everybody has a copy because you don't communicate by your mouth as much as you can if they can see it. If you really want to get something across, you do it that way. Right. I was in a house once. I'm in a house often. And can I have another 5 minutes? Is that allowed? And if those have got to go. All right, you know. The uncommitted, they're going to catch buses. but I was in this home, and as I say, I like to read something. And I often look around the books that are in their house, and sometimes you find something fun, and I read it. But this was General Horrocks. who was a general under Montgomery in the Second World War in the desert in Al Alamein, and the advance of the 8th Army and the New Zealand's great infantry, the best infantry in the world. At that time they were. No, they had the greatest reputation of any infantry in the world, the New Zealand infantry. Tremendous. I'd love you to read about some of the exploits of the New Zealand infantry. Courage like nobody else. I'm talking really the Anzacs, I guess. They were together. And who was it? Little tiny, what's his name, that combined them. The British used to complain that you guys with your slouch hats and us guys never saluted this guy. And they said, your men don't salute. I was thinking of the Anzacs, but I'm using New Zealand. It was the expeditionary force of New Zealand, Australia. And he said, they don't salute back. He said, try smiling. Or try waving, he said. Yeah, try waving. And that was the way the Aussies and Kiwis get on. However, General Horrocks was planning a major advance against the enemy lines that had never yet been penetrated. And he was working on it, but in the afternoon he was got all done. And typical British fellow, you know, sitting in his deck chair there with a glass of champagne and a book. And Montgomery sent one of his aides-de-camp to just check up that everything was ready for the advance. And when this guy got there to General Horrocks in the afternoon about 3 o'clock, saw him sitting in his deck chair with his glass of champagne and reading a book and all the troops lounging round, he hit the roof. He said, what do you think you're doing? We're getting ready for a major advance on the enemy tonight at 10 o'clock tonight, and you're sitting in your deck chair drinking champagne, reading a book, and your troops are lounging around the place. What do you think you're doing? Is everything ready? And his reply was marvellous. The only thing I remember of the book, he said this, sir, he didn't mean that, sir, this is the point, if we were not now prepared, if we were not now prepared, the battle would be already lost. And we lose a lot of battles because we never do the preparation. The battle's lost before we start the camp. The battle's lost before we get into the pulpit. The battle's lost before we start the game. We've blown it long before we get there. If we were not now prepared, the battle would be already lost. And how many times we start a project and we've cut short the preparation and we've messed it up. I talked to you about, I'll just whip down these acetates very, very quickly. I'll leave that one. We talked about the three M's of organisation. I think I did this at the weekend somewhere. Everything starts with a man or a woman with an idea or a vision. The Brethren movement was once a vision. And now people talk about it being a movement. You've heard about the Brethren movement? I've heard about the Brethren movement. But it goes from a man with a vision to a movement, then it becomes a machine, and then it becomes a monument, and the only thing that you use monuments for are the pigeons. We all know what they do. And it's dead. And you have to reassess your church, your work. It started off as a vision with an original glorious vision. You were unstoppable. Then it became a movement. We didn't convey the ideas to the next crowd. And then it became a machine, and there are a lot of missionary societies. There's one missionary I will not name, but over 80% of the money that missionary society gets is in their administration. Over 80% is in it. They're just keeping a monument polished, not doing anything. You've read C.T. Studd's little book, I think it was C.T. Studd, about the lighthouse keeper. You know that one? You got time for that? You got time for that? Sorry, time. And there was this lighthouse. These people actually on the coast, they didn't have a lighthouse, they're just on the coast. And a shiver bereft, you see. And these guys would get in their boats and they'd row through the storm, just ordinary fishermen, great big heads, row there, you see. And they'd pick up the survivors and they'd row back and bring the poor people up on the shore, spitting out, you know, salt water and oil and everything else, and drag them up, take them into their homes and wrap blankets around them and get them warm, you see. They were great people. Got a vision for saving the lost. See where we go? Well, then one of the people that had been rescued was a very wealthy person, so he sent them some money to build a beautiful big lighthouse. A life-saving station, rather. And they built this beautiful life-saving station. Carpet on the floor, showers, toilets, reception room where they brought the people, beautiful boats. And they said, oh, we don't want to save people now. If we go and start rescuing all these gaudy people, they're going to make a mess of it. So they stopped rescuing the people, you see. And a few of the original core said, look, this isn't what it's about. They went down the coast. And they started rescuing people again and dragging them in and putting them in their houses, warming them and loving them. But then somebody gave them some money and a few of the crowd built a beautiful lighthouse station. And they didn't want the drunks and the drug addicts and the dirty people and the broken homes and the sluts and all the rest of it. They just wanted nice people. And they just became a machine. And how many churches do you and I know? And that's just it. Originally, 10 years ago, a couple went into that district with a real burden for souls and they established a church. Now you've got to wipe your feet before you go in and blow your nose and hang your hat up. And if you've got a bit of a smell on your breath, you're not wanted. And if you ladies don't wear a head covering, then you're out. And they've lost the whole vision. That's it. Make sure whatever you're involved in, it never ever loses its vision. And you don't have to lose that vision. You get it renewed every day from the Lord Jesus. So I've said, I'll just whip through these quickly. You've got your notes. In a camp, I did these this afternoon, so you're not all going to put up with them. In a camp, there are many tasks towards the final goal. The problem is, people become obsessed with their little task and they forget the goal. You follow what I mean? They've just got a little job. And they won't see how their job fits into the whole. And so you must realize that everything has to become subservient to the main goal. This illustration here is about a man who went onto a building site. And they were building a cathedral, as I've suggested there. And there was a man laying bricks and building a beautiful brick pier. Magnificent. And this fellow went up and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm just laying bricks." "Oh, I see." And there was another man putting in beautiful stained glass in the stained glass window. Magnificent job. Putting in the lead and getting it perfect. He said to him, "And what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm just installing the glass." He went along to another man. He was a labourer. Just a labourer. With a wheelbarrow. And he had some mortar in it. And this guy with a wheelbarrow was going along. "What are you, excuse me, sir. What are you doing?" "Building a cathedral." Who had the vision? The labourer. The other guy was just building a pillar, just laying bricks. The other guy was just putting in glass, but this guy, he was only an ordinary labourer, he hadn't got much brains. He hadn't got the skill of the brick, hadn't got the skill of the glazier, but he'd got the vision, building a cathedral. What are you doing in your thing? "I'm running games. I'm cooking in the kitchen." No, I'm not. I'm building a church for Jesus Christ. Everybody's important. Never ever lose the vision. We're building a cathedral. Okay, so there are three things I've talked about there, and I'll just have to leave those. They're very important. I've taken for granted that you realise the important factors are prayer. I'm rather thrilled. I didn't start it. We have prayer times, but our own staff this year have a prayer meeting on a Wednesday morning at 6. And rather thrilling. The presence of the Holy Spirit and the availability of each person. I've made the point, because we're talking about leadership, the church is not just a collection of organisations. To overemphasise one part is to neglect the others. So coordination. Make sure that you do coordinate every aspect of whatever work you're in so that people relate to each other and support each other. There's no one answer to all the problems that you have. There's a multiplicity of answers. So learn to get on with others and teach coordination. Liaison. Communication between all aspects of your personnel. Open, often, and organised. I know some camps and some organisations. I talk on Sunday school work a lot. One of the things I lecture on, I believe in Sunday schools and done a lot of work there. And the Sunday school that does not have a leaders meeting once a month is not in business for God. I don't care what they say. I'll fight that with anybody. They're not in business for God. They're playing games. They don't have a Sunday school teachers meeting once a month. They're not in business for God. They're never going to win. That's why 90% of our Sunday school is in Australasia pathetic. I am a rally person. I represent New Zealand as a rally person. That's not being pompous, that's a fact. But I still believe, in spite of the fact that I am a rally representative, I still believe a Sunday school properly run has got more success than the Every Boys, Every Girls rally movement. But we've lost the vision of the Sunday school. And the people in the rally have got more get up and go, more vision. That's why the rallies are better than the Sunday schools. I mean, Sunday school is no good. Just we've run out of steam. Lost the vision. It's just become a monument. We just babysit the assembly's kids. Don't make a very good job of that. All right, liaison. And then between groups, we've talked about that. And then the last one that I've got down here, and I've just got two little aspects to show you, is cooperation. So coordination. Liaison, so that every aspect of your group knows what the others are doing. That's why our minutes are important in our camp. And then we cooperate, I hope, with each section, with each other. No room for loners. And I said there, watch out for the strong, natural leader. To conclude, and we're way over time, I apologise for that, someone said, the surest way to fail, the surest way not to fail, is to determine to succeed. And that brings me back to somewhere where we started. Intensity. You're a leader. You may be in the kitchen. The kitchen's one of the most important places in the camp. Happy kitchen, happy camp. People have got a full stomach and nice food. You've got a happy camp. I've preached at lots of camps. The food's been abysmal. The beds have been miserable, and you can preach your socks off. Everyone is so unhappy. That's what the founder of the Salvation Army, General Booth, said. No man ever got converted with toothache, and never man ever listened to the gospel with an empty stomach. That's why he filled their stomachs and gave them mental care. Then when he'd done that, he sat them down and preached at them. And I guess the kitchen is the center of any camp you've got. Happy kitchen, happy camp. And we're always check up very carefully on the people we have in the kitchen. They've got to be lovely people. They put up with all sorts of things. You know, you never put up with an ordinary kitchen. Kids come in with a cut finger, somebody comes in and nicks the sausage that you were cooking, you'd counted the things, and somebody else puts a spoon down dirty, and people leave knives out, and they cut a knife on the stainless steel, and you've just sharpened it. But you're doing it for God. So you tell the Lord all about it. All right, intensity. Inspiration is your conviction. Application with a will and enthusiasm. Concentration. Think what you're doing. Think ahead. Perspiration. Be willing to sweat. You know, bit of inspiration, a lot of perspiration. You must go in for what you believe in. And win or lose, you must be able to live with the knowledge you gave it your best. Okay, so it didn't work out. So we lost. Boy, we gave it the best shot we had. It wasn't a success. I'll say this. If you have a bright idea, it's in your notes there somewhere. You have a bright idea as a leader, and it doesn't work out, don't throw it in the rubbish tin. Ask yourself the question, the idea was a good one. Was it the execution of the idea that botched it? If we do it another way, will we win? And there's no greater thrill than doing something for the Lord Jesus and seeing it richly blessed and people come to know him. You know, it's amazing, the people you see and you meet, if you're involved in youth work particularly, the people you see, and I hope you enjoy the lecture next week because we've talked about a lot about the problems of youth in regard to the philosophy of camp. But as you see these kids change, you see their lives change, and some of you have been in youth work a long time, and you've seen kids saved 10 years ago, and now they're married and got a young family. And it was worth the effort, wasn't it? You were tired, exasperated. It was worth the effort. And so we said a few basic things about leadership. There's really about four lectures there in that lot that you had in 4 hours there, because I do 1.5 hour lectures, and so you've had about in those three notes, more than that, and you had a long time. So we've rushed through it. I hope you find the notes a help. If you want the master of this, you might like to get it. I'll leave it with Andrew. If anybody wants it, tell Andrew now. And it's what you might like to use in the roles of your members. Are they the production role? They're an organizer, an initiator, a data collector, and so on. They're maintenance roles. They're an encourager, a follower, a negotiator, a protector, a servant. But these are the ones you want to look out for. Anti-team roles, a dominator, a blocker, an attention seeker, an avoider. And sometimes it's a good idea to have a chart like that. I do with our staff. And I mark them 1 to 10. This person is a brilliant organizer. They're a bit of a dominator. And I work out my staff. I never show the staff. I work it out and I screw it up and burn it. I never leave it around. I would never do that. But I just want to know where I think my staff is and where maybe I need to put some work in. And the other thing about leadership, if you're a leader, spend time with your staff. Walking leadership is one of the most important methods of leadership. And I don't do it, but I try to get around my staff every day. I don't do it. But I've got 14 of the staff, 16 of the staff, and I can't get around them all in a day. But I'll say, right, it's 10 o'clock. I give myself 20 minutes, and I walk. Hi, Brad, how are you? What are you doing? Tremendous. Great start. How's everything going? Okay. Or we just chat, and I go to this guy. How are things going? Drift through the kitchen. Boy, your kitchen looks pretty good. Hey, this could do a bit of a clean down. Oh, tell you what, give me a bottle of water. Let's do it now. I'll give you a hand. And I'll wash the bench down with him, you see. Don't criticize, not fair to help. And then I walk around and always notice what people have done. A guy's been slogging his heart out there, putting a fence in. And it's been done for a week and you haven't even been able to see it. Now, he may have done it for the Lord, but we all like a compliment. Walk and see it. When they're picking up the blackberries, I haven't got time to go down there and pick blackberries and kiwi fruit and all that, but I make sure I join in, even just for half an hour. I work there, get there. So your walking management is very, very important. Two good little books, the 1 Minute Manager and the 1 Minute Manager in Action. Well worth getting one, well worth reading. Good books. But try it. If you're in any leadership position, make sure your staff see you outside your office and walking and sharing with them. And it's so important. And I try to get around my staff. At least in 2 days, I try to talk to everybody. Or at least ring them on the phone. And while I'm away from home, I write to a different staff member every day. So all my staff will get letters. I put 3 or 4 letters in one letter, Judy, because the mail is so expensive. But I've written to all our staff, and I'm starting again to write to all our staff again. And the children. But I write a letter a day. It's only just a little letter. 2 pages about that size of the pad I've got. That's all it is. And nobody can make an excuse for not writing a letter like that. 2 pages of those. All I've got. A little pad. And I sit down there. Dear Stan, Lorraine, thinking of you today, you know. I'm having a marvellous time here in Sydney. Beautiful, hot, rave, 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 rave. How are you getting on with your blackberries? Here it's raining. Ha ha, guess who God loves. And, but then I'll say something. You know, I'll say, you know, something like, by the way, you kids, or whoever, I do want you to know, you know, how much you're loved and appreciated that place. It's so good being away from camp and knowing that you are there. Now, what did that cost me? 5 minutes of my time, a little bit of my heart, because you've got to be honest, a 50-cent stamp, an envelope, and that's all. But if I want to ever say anything to that guy that may be something that he disagrees with, I've earned the right. A leader serves. Cleans their shoes. The Lord Jesus washed the disciples' feet. And if you'll never ever think, oh, shut up, Aaron. Never ever think, I'll go on, that you have earned the right to be served. I have been a director at Totara Springs Camp for 16 years. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and poured the concrete paths. I've groomed the horses. My wife cooked the meals. You kids don't understand. It's time that I was served. If once you get that idea, then you have just put yourself on the shelf. The more you're given the opportunity in success, the greater your depth of service. Once you think the church or your camp or your staff or anybody owes you a living, you have just blown your service for the Lord Jesus. Never feel the world or the church owes you a living. Because if you do, you didn't serve the Lord, you blew it. And the higher you get, the more humble you should be in your service. And people should see it.